So let's get started. Are there any questions? Okay. So we were discussing clustering, and we were discussing k-means, and we were ending towards the end of last class, we were talking about problems with k-means, and some of the problems were you need to know k in advance, and that's a tricky problem, and we don't know the answer to that. As I mentioned, this thing doesn't work. The answer to that, as I mentioned, is that you essentially have to look for the knee in the so essentially, as you increase the number of clusters, the intra-cluster dissimilarities, the sum of intra-cluster dissimilarities is going to go down. So there's not too much you can do in terms of finding the smallest value for that. So instead, what you need to do is either look at the places where it seems to change in the rate of descent is slowing down, or basically consider throwing this as an optimization problem where the number of clusters are added as a cost term. So if you have too many clusters, the overall cost increases. Okay. Now, even if you do this, in essence, it's not very clear what is the right number of. So if you want to do this, you need to decide what is the cost you should associate per cluster. Okay. It depends on, ultimately it depends on what's the right number of clusters for a particular application. Okay. So the best people can do is to see if in fact, let's say you have been in the past, you have looked at for this particular kind of application, if you have looked at the fact that the number of clusters is below certain number, then you would have to try to set the cost of the clusters in such a way that you don't cross that. Okay. So ultimately, I think actually the version that I like better is think in terms of, if you have all the time in the world, think in terms of how does the sum of intra-cluster dissimilarity measure keep going down, and then look for the knees in that. Okay. The other one is, this is a bigger problem too, which is you can actually reach different local minima based on the seeds that you start from. Okay, and we will look at, there are two possible ways of dealing with this. One simple idea, of course, is to consider multiple centroids, multiple seeds. Okay, so try starting 5-6 times with very different sets of seeds, and then find which is the one that leads to the best clustering. Okay, now a version of this is called, actually let me see if I can get this, yeah, a version of this is called bisecting k-means. It's a neat algorithm, and in fact you can think of this also this is an answer for a different point. What bisecting k-means is an idea where you are using the idea of which clustering to use. So let's look at the algorithm. So you are still deciding that there are k clusters, okay, rather than start with some number k seeds and find the clustering with respect to that. What you do is you start with all the data points in the same cluster, and then you try to split. You pick a cluster, you try to split it. Okay, so use the k-means to split a given cluster into two subclusters, C1 and C2. okay, and choose the best of above splits. So the idea is you do, you know, during the iterations of this algorithm, you might essentially have some number of clusters. It's less than k still. So here is one cluster C1, here is another cluster C2, here is another cluster C3. Okay. And you could either split C1 into 2, C2 into 2, or C3 into 2. So what you would do is, for some number of iterations, you would pick a cluster, okay, and pick 2 points from that cluster and try to use k-means clustering on that with k equal to 2, okay, and see which of the clusters that you get are the best. And then you pick that particular split. So if you wind up splitting C1 into C1 dash and C2 dash, right, now you have an extra cluster. Okay, so the interesting thing is, in the beginning, you have the entire data set, which would then have been split into C1 and C2. Then maybe C1 would have been split into C1 dash, C2 dash, and so on. Okay, so the total number of clusters at the leaf nodes would be k in number. But the way you get these k would be to start from the top and iteratively splitting them. So you can think of this also as a sort of a hierarchical clustering method where you are actually dividing. You're dividing the cluster, you know, piece by piece by piece. Okay. Oh. The other issues with respect to the k-means clustering is the notion of outliers. So the problem is, in general, the way we describe k-means clustering, it must ensure that every point is in some cluster or other. And secondly, every point is in exactly one cluster. Okay, both of these can be problems. The way to avoid the requirement that every point must be in exactly one cluster and not more than one cluster is to consider soft clustering that I mentioned earlier, wherein you say you allow a cluster to a point to fall in this cluster with 0.7 membership and another cluster with 0.3 membership. Okay. A more interesting issue is, of course, some points should not be in should not be considered in any clusters at all. Okay, they should be essentially removed from the cluster because they are noise. Okay, I don't know how many of you have looked at the mail I sent about using k-means to cluster grades. And sometimes you can get much better clustering if you remove the outlier. Okay, an outlier point. Okay, and then do k-means. Because of the outlier, the clusters would wind up taking unnatural shapes. Okay. Unnatural configuration. Now the problem, of course, is there are ways of avoiding outliers in k-means. You have to use k-medoids. Okay, because if you remember from the old days, medians are more robust with respect to noise than means. This is why IRS talks about household median income, because they take mean. Then, you know, the really poor people who and really, really rich people would just affect the average too much. Okay, the fact that one Bill Gates is there changes everything. Okay, so median does not get changed by the outliers. Now, the only problem, of course, is while it sounds nice, actually doing k-medoid clustering is not all that easy, because one advantage of doing means is computation of means essentially is just you compute the centroid and you compute the distance between the centroid and each point. Okay, for the medioids, you essentially have to look to compute the median. You almost have to look at all the points. Okay, and decide what is the median vector. Okay, so there are answers for outliers, but in general, that's not a very effective answer. Another approach would be to remove the outlier to begin with. Okay, just remove it from consideration. To do that and then do k-means. So So midoid essentially leaves everybody in and just takes medians. Okay. Do people understand what is a median vector given a bunch of vectors? Okay. So it would be, so if I am given a bunch of vectors, ai plus bj and a dash I plus b dash j and a double dash I plus b double dash j, then the midoid of this would be the median of these three numbers, median of a dash a double dash I plus median of b dash b double dash j. Okay, that's one way of defining. Yes, sir. What do you, no, the centroid is basically, the, I mean, all of these are central, all of these are estimates of the center of the data. Okay, mean is one way of estimating the center of the data, median is another way. Median is more robust with respect to outliers.
Is the formula different?
What?
For the median.
Uh-huh. No, but just median of three numbers. You know how to compute the median of any number. These are all numbers, right? Yes.
But, I mean, I'm just looking at that formula. Mm-hmm. Is the median defined as the being in the set of, say, vectors or numbers itself? And it doesn't necessarily
that definition. That's a good point.
Yeah, because you might get a completely different vector. You get one of the vectors.
It depends. Actually, I think I'm confused now. I have to look at this, but. Another way would be to compute the centroid and compute the vector which is closest, the actual point which is closest to the centroid. That might be another way of defining median. So, if you want median to be part of the data, then, you know. But see the other issue is this one does have median being, I don't know, let me see. See, the problem is if you do it that way, you're no longer robust with respect to outliers. Because centroid already got affected by the mean. I mean, the centroid already got affected by the Bill Gates. Okay. So, again, I think when you go from one dimensions to multi-dimensions, then there are differences. Wait, you know, I think one way I recall was to do it this way. But there is the advantage of having a median be something that's actually present in the data. And the usual thing that you do is take the centroid and look for the data point that's closest. Okay. Now, of course, you could also do this thing wherein you can remove outliers upfront, but then you need, and then do k-means. But, and in fact, in clustering literature in general, removal of outliers is a big thing. And the way you remove outliers, how do you remove outliers? How do you define an outlier to begin with? So the way outlier is defined is in terms of neighborhoods. Okay, so if an outlier is one where within a neighborhood around that point, there are no other data points. Okay, and that's the usual way you wind up defining outliers. And so for that, you actually have to have neighborhood-based, there are these data structures actually called R-trees. Which allow you to, so the way I'm defining outliers now is you talk about a neighborhood for a point, and then say something is an outlier with respect to a neighborhood and an epsilon neighborhood and a delta number of minimum neighbors that must be there in the neighborhood. Okay, and if you make the epsilon bigger and bigger, then somebody will be there. And then similarly, if you make delta smaller and smaller, nobody would be an outlier. Okay, but for an epsilon delta, you can decide what are the points that are actually outliers. That means they have less than delta number of data points in their epsilon neighborhood. Okay. Now you can define the epsilon neighborhood in terms of your distance, you know, the spherical distance. You can, epsilon defines a sphere around the point, data point that you are talking about, and then you look at whether other points fall in that. There are ways of doing this. which actually improve, and removing outliers this way and then doing k-means, it does improve performance in terms of clustering. Okay. Now the other things, one other thing that I don't think I mentioned last time is that the time complexity of k-means clustering is essentially linear, okay, in the number of points. So if you look at this, the computing, let's say computing the distance between any two documents is O of M, where M is the number of dimensions, that is number of keywords in the document, which is a reasonable thing to say. And then during, when you are reassigning clusters, you essentially come doing KN distance computations, where each distance computation is of the order of M, where M is the number of dimensions of the document. Okay, and then the computing of the centroids is essentially adding everybody up and dividing. Okay, so that's again ONM. And if you do it for L iterations, it's OLKNM. The nice thing is everything, it's linearly dependent on every possible parameter. The number of iterations, the number of dimensions, the number of points, the number of clusters K, everything. Okay, so this is a big advantage for k-means clustering. People like it because it's linear in all the dimensions. And in comparison, actually we'll see in a minute that the hierarchical clustering algorithms, one version we'll talk about called agglomerative clustering, actually is n-squared. Okay, and so it's large, much higher complexity in terms of number of points. And then we'll look at a version which combines both those ideas. This we talked about almost as I was describing the k-means idea, that you don't need to compute centroid for each iteration. You can incrementally recompute the centroid, and that reduces the number of iterations you have to do. The number of, instead of thinking in terms of iterations, think in terms of the number of reassignments that you have to do. The total number of reassignments, if you are doing it in a synchronous way, is equal to the number of iterations, and in each iteration how many reassignments got done. Okay. Whereas if you recompute centroid at every iteration, every reassignment, then you can reduce the number of reassignments. And then we already talked about the importance of good seeds. Outlier problem, this is, okay. Couple of other things, actually I think I'll skip this. We can come back to this later. So let's look at the other version of the standard clustering algorithms, which is hierarchical clustering, where the other one is called flat clustering, because you assume all clusters are at the same level, and you're just splitting them, okay? Except the bisecting k-means already was sort of hierarchical, so forget about that for a minute. So in the hierarchical clustering, you're sort of starting, you know, either with small clusters and building them up, or starting with a big cluster and splitting it down. Either way, you sort of have defined a hierarchy of clusters. Okay. Now, it has some advantages in terms of conceptual understanding, because you tend to think of, let's say, if you look at something like DMOS or Yahoo directory, it looks at all topics of the world, which is split into science topics, whatever, you know, entertainment topics, some other topics, and then those are then split further down. Now, each of those headings are really clusters. So it does look as if it makes sense to think in terms of hierarchical organization of clusters. Okay. Now, the only question, of course, is one thing what we'll see here is the hierarchies that we get may or may not necessarily have clean semantics in terms of, you know, this cluster corresponding to something that's recognizable in the domain. But let's see how you could compute this hierarchical clustering. One interesting point is that when you're doing hierarchical clustering, you actually wind up having to talk about distance between clusters, distance between two clusters. This is something that we didn't do in K clustering, K means clustering, because you knew exactly K clusters were there, and all you cared about was reassignment of points in terms of centroid, distance to the centroid. Okay. So anyway, there are two ideas in hierarchical clustering. One, of course, is start from the big cluster and keep splitting it. Those are the divisive ones. And the bisecting k-means is an example, the one that I showed in the beginning of the class. And the other is start from the bottom, that is, assume that every data point as it is its own cluster and go up. Okay, that's the usual, that's agglomerative, that means it's kind of glumming together clusters to make it bigger and bigger. Okay, the thing in this agglomerative clustering is there is, you don't ask the tough question as to how many clusters are there. There is no such thing as how many clusters. Okay, you start at the lowest level. Here, for example, every point is its own cluster. If you start off, but at this point, essentially, they are within the cluster. The points within the cluster are one similar to each other. That means they're perfectly similar to each other. Okay. Now, as you go down like this, by here, 0.93 means if you cut here, essentially, you are considering, let's say if you cut here, what are you doing? You still have one as a cluster, you still have six as a cluster, but because you're cutting here, 2A, 4, and 3 are together one cluster now. And you act as if they are identical because you assume that if you don't, if you assume that everything which is 0.93 similar to each other are actually identically similar to each other, then you would wind up thinking this whole thing is together, but this is different, this is different. Okay, so it's just a question of resolution at which you are looking at the world. You know, if you start making every, I mean, if you care about perfect identicality, this is where you have to be. If you don't care about any level of identicality, then, you know, you can at some point of time, at some level, the entire data set is similar. So it's just one cluster. And based on where you situate yourself, you get some number of clusters, which is look at the world. So that's the advantage, one advantage of hierarchical clustering, because you don't have to think about what is k. Now, what would you do? How would you do this? It's very simple. You start from every element as its own cluster, okay? And at each iteration, you pick a pair of clusters that are closest to each other, and then say you are now one cluster. Okay, now the tricky point, of course, the variations will come in terms of how do you define, it's actually at each point you take a pair of clusters C1 and C2 that are most mergeable pair, and then say they're together. So the most mergeable is what? How do you define most mergeable clusters? You can define it in terms of distances again, okay? So you could say the two closest clusters. Now, we already talked last class that given two clusters, the distance between the two clusters is not obvious. You can decide the distance between two clusters to be the closest distance between any two points, with one point in this and another point on that. That's called the single link. As a complete link, which is the farthest distance between any pair of points, or average distance between a point from here and a point from there. And depending on the way you define the distance, you will decide to merge different points. So you'll get a different hierarchy. Yes?
What if you have more than two? Say, take each one, the first split is not into two categories, but into what? 8, 10 categories?
Yes, I agree. No, the thing is, hierarchical agglomerative clustering basically does this thing called dendrogram, which is two array splits. Okay, having made the two array splits, then you can play with it to make it into multi-array splits later on. But out of the box, this algorithm basically just computes a dendrogram. Okay, a dendrogram is a hierarchy with two array splits at every point. Okay, but your point is well taken. In fact, one thing you can do is, after the H hack does its thing, then you can go into the hierarchy and say, you know, you can flatten it further. And one way of flattening it is basically saying, well, you know, so you can actually get, let's see, okay, So in this case, here you have 1 and 1. Okay, you can flatten it by saying this entire thing is one branch here, this one thing is one branch, and these two are one branch. So that can be done as a post-processing, an extra step. Okay, but the hack that I'm describing here essentially does two-way merge at each point. Okay, this is exactly the reason I said at the top you tend to motivate this in terms of, look, DMOS has nice hierarchies, so we should have hierarchies. Okay, and yet actually the way you're getting a hierarchy, the hierarchy that you get may not have anything to do with the DMOS hierarchy. What's more interesting actually is these dendrograms are found naturally in evolutionary trees of how organisms may have evolved. Okay, there was like the primordial slime, which then split into two other pieces, and then it split into two other pieces, then it split into two other pieces. At every point for each mutation, the organism split into two different lines of growth. Okay, so if you look at where are we in the evolution, and this is assuming, you know, if you look at the evolutionary tree, it's a dendrogram. Okay, so what's interesting is since evolutionary tree happens to be a dendrogram, and you don't necessarily know the exact places where splits have occurred evolutionarily. We know some parts, but we don't know everything. Large pieces are missing. Okay, so what do biologists do these days? They would try to actually fill in gaps by using clustering techniques and hoping that the clustering technique, since this is dendrogram, that's dendrogram, maybe this will actually tell the reality. Okay, now you might laugh, but really using unsupervised learning has this weird semantics that you're hoping that the clustering would find the inherent truth of the world. Okay, and you know, you remember that to say whether, if you happen to know what are the real clusters of the world, then after your algorithm runs, then you can tell whether it's been good or bad in terms of the external cluster validation measures. But if it is truly unsupervised, then you don't actually know what are the clusters in the world or whether there are even clusters in the world. But you give a k-means algorithm some data, do you think it will say, you know, I don't really believe that there are k clusters here. There are only two clusters here. It will never say that. It will find you k clusters. Okay, and the clusters that it found may or may not have anything to do with what the kind of clusters you are looking for, because maybe the distances are wrongly defined. As I mentioned last class, if what I want to do is hopefully divide you guys into people who will pass the exam versus fail the exam, and I define distances in terms of the differences in hair lengths, I get a cluster. But that may or may not have anything to do with anything that I would be interested in. Okay? So you'll get a dendrogram for a hierarchical clustering, and still, even for those dendrograms, it's a question of which ones you get depend upon how you define the distance between two clusters. And single link versus multi-link will have different meanings. Okay. Now, here is a simple example. So if you have 1, 2, 5, 6, 7, which are one-dimensional data points, okay, so up front, you pick everybody is a cluster, so there are 5 clusters. Then you pick any 2 clusters which are closest to each other. Okay. So 1 and 2 are one away from each other, 5 and 6 are one away from each other, 6 and 7 are also one away from each other. Okay, let's assume you picked one of them. All of them are equally good. Okay, and so you picked 1 and 2. So that was the first cluster. I made it into a cluster. Okay, now this cluster centroid now is in some sense 1.5. Okay, Now, in what I am doing right now, I will assume that the distance between two clusters is defined in terms of their centroidal distance. In what I am doing right now, okay. So this is 1 and 2, and then so this will be 1.5. So my three new clusters really are 1.5, 5, 6, and 7. Now you pick 2, which are closest, okay, and then merge them. So I picked 5 and 6 in this case, and so 1.5, 5.5, and 7. And then the next time I pick these two, so in which case I get that. And I have one cluster now, so I stop. Okay. Now it's clear that if I define distances, I mean in this case I define distances between between points in terms of centroidal distance, between clusters in terms of that centroidal distance. Okay. But you could do it in other ways. So for example, in this particular case, suppose I consider single link versus complete link. Okay. Now in this particular case, in the beginning, those would be the first four, clearly, irrespective of what distance measure you use. Because there's no difference between single link and complete link if the cluster has a singleton. There's only one point. But the moment now you have non-singleton clusters, if you're using singleton, then which clusters are close to each other? Top twos are close, bottom twos are close. So, you know, if you use single link clustering, you would get that. Next clustering, and then the big clustering. Okay. In the same way, if I do complete link clustering, the first four would still be the same, but this time, since the distance between two clusters is defined in terms of the maximum distance between any pair of points. Okay. So these guys are this distance away. Okay. So these two clusters are. I'm sorry. Yeah. These two clusters are that distance away, these two clusters are that distance away, these two clusters are that distance away, and so on. Of them, obviously, you can see these are closer. Okay, so you would cluster them, and you'll cluster that. Now, these are two different hierarchies now. Which one is the Yahoo hierarchy? No clue. Okay, because it depends upon a bunch of arbitrary decisions we made in terms of how to define clusters, how to define distances, okay, between clusters. Okay. So there are single link, normally what happens, as I mentioned last time, single link clustering tends to provide chain clusters, these thin elongated clusters you get to get. Okay. Whereas complete link clustering gets you more spherical clusters. Okay. Now these two are two extremes. You can also try other kinds of things, like the version that I said earlier was just centroidal distance between two clusters, which is very cheap to do. And a fourth one really is group average similarity. So you consider one point from this cluster, one point from that cluster, compute that distance. Add it to the, for every pair of points you compute the distance, take the average of those distances. That would be the average distance between, so it's better than the centroidal distance because it takes the spread of points in the cluster. Okay. Now, normally this is a painful distance measure. The only reason I brought this up is actually it has a quite cute connection to the way we tend to compute distances in text documents, which is this dot product based similarity. For dot product based similarity, notice what happens. So what you are trying to compute is di from C1 cluster, dj from C2. You want to take the dot product of di and dj. Okay? And then how many pairs are there? The total number of pairs are C1 times C2. C1 size of C1 cluster and C2 is the size of C2 cluster. So this is what you are trying to compute. Right? Now if you kind of play with the summation signs, then it is this whole thing dot this whole thing. Okay? And this is just nothing but the centroid of the first one. And this is centroid of the second one. So if you just take the centroidal distance it winds up being the same. The centroidal distance between two clusters winds up being the same as the group pair average clustering. So that's kind of cute. This is true definitely for this particular vector similarity, dot product based measure. Okay. So we have a complete binary tree or dendrogram of clusters if you do hierarchical clustering. And as I said, we have various ways of deciding which clusters can be merged, single link, complete link, group average, centroidal distance. Okay. It runs in O(n) square time. That's the tricky part. Instead of O(n) time, it's O(n) square time. Okay, because you are repeatedly considering merging pairs of clusters. Okay. In text, now coming back to the text-based, you know, clustering in the text documents, there is a paper actually that's number 2 in the list of clustering papers. I asked you to read the chapters for the primary reading, but the second one is this paper by Steinbeck and Vipin Kumar. It's a nice paper because it's a short paper that tries to do a comparative study of the effectiveness of k-means, hierarchical clustering, and bunch of other clustering algorithms on text documents. Now, this is slightly old, and I think pendulum is swinging back and forth, and there are variations of each of these, multiple variations of each of these. But it's nice to see that paper. It's a very short paper, and you could read that and get the idea that originally people used, I mean, this paper, by this time of this paper, hierarchical clustering was considered to be good for text documents. But then these guys do a reasonable amount of external as well as internal evaluation of the clustering, and then argue that actually k-means and bisecting k-means do better than hierarchical clustering. Okay, but it's interesting to see the way the argument goes more than just the truth of the argument, because the truth of the argument I'm not completely sure. But to argue this, you need to set up empirical studies, you need to talk about internal validation, you also need to talk about external validation measures. Okay. There's actually books written on clustering algorithms, and these are just the first two, the simplest versions, and there are too many variations on just these two. And we already looked at some, but I'll look at one last one and then move out of the clustering and then talk some little bit more about the text clustering, more specific to text clustering. This one is a version where you kind of combine both. Hierarchical clustering and k-means. Okay, the issue is trying to figure out how to get the clusters, how to get the centers, the best centers. Remember, one of the problems in k-means is figuring out the best seeds to start from. And our best idea essentially was try a bunch of k-seeds a few times and look at which clustering winds up having the best dissimilarity and pick that. Okay, this one essentially says do a hack on a sample of the data, do a hierarchical agglomerative clustering on the sample of the data. Okay, and if the sample is representative, then potentially the clustering of the data on the sample is similar to the clustering of the data on the full data. Okay, and then what if you know that you want k clusters, if you've done hierarchical clustering, if you want to know if you want k clusters, then you go from here until you have exactly k clusters. And when you get the k clusters, you take the centroids of those k clusters as the seeds. Centroids of the k clusters of the sample as the seeds, and then run the k means on the full data. Okay. Now, the sample is square root n, and the only reason the sample is square root n is
O of
n. That's all. Okay, because hierarchical clustering is n square complexity. So if you start with a sample of size square root n, then it's square root n square, so it's still n complexity plus another n complexity. So you are not doing too much extra work. Okay, I'm not necessarily saying that this is one of the great methods. It's just ways of using one approach to make up for the deficiencies of other approach in this case. So k-means is actually a great algorithm, it runs fast, but it requires the centroids correctly. Okay. Now, the bisecting k-means, let me see, this is one point I wanted to make about bisecting k-means. Yeah, there you go. You could actually use the bisecting k-means idea to decide when to stop. Okay? For example, if you find that at some point of time the best cluster that you can split winds up having so how do you choose the best of the splits? How do you choose the best of the splits in this bisecting k-means? Because within this part, right, you do have the same number of, so if I have, let's say, if I have three clusters, C1, C2, C3, when I came into the second loop, okay, then I'm considering splitting C1, considering splitting C2, considering splitting C3. Multiple times, right? Now, any time I split, I will get a new cluster of exactly four clusters. Since the number of clusters is constant, I can compare the best all those four clusters in terms of sum of dissimilarity over the four clusters. Sum of dissimilarity over the four clusters. So that's what you're doing essentially. Now, since you are going incrementally from 2 to 3, 3 to 4, 4 to 5, 5 to 6, right, you can actually do this knee thing that I was talking to you about. So you, in essence, you are going incrementally and you are essentially following this curve in a way, because you did k equal to 2, k equal to 3 and so on. So you could actually keep the history of how much, not only what is the best for what is the best sum dissimilarity is for the four clusters, but how much better is it with the best three clusters that you came from? Okay, that's the improvement. And you can keep track of the improvement and decide not to go further at some point of time. So that actually can be used as a way of, so basically here I'm making it sound as if you go all the way to k, but I'm suggesting that you can improve the intelligence here a little bit such that you keep track of how the sum of intra-cluster dissimilarity is falling. Okay, so you can do online judgment of the knee because you actually are computing the knee here. Okay. So that's an advantage in this particular case. Okay, any questions? Okay. So a little bit more with respect to the text clustering itself. So both hack and k-means have been applied to text clustering in more or less a straightforward way. The distance measures, of course, are the issue. What distances do you use? And as I said, in fact, you may as well use the TF-IDF similarities, which are basically dot product based. And dot product distances have some advantages, actually. Okay. Just as I showed you that if you have dot product distance, the group average cluster distance is going to be in terms of centroids. You can also show to yourself that if you are defining tightness of a cluster in terms of the average distance between any pair of points in that cluster, tightness of a cluster being average distance between any point, pair of points in the cluster, or even the sum of all the distances, whichever we want to. Let's consider the average. Okay. Now, what would happen essentially is you would be taking so you're going to be taking di and dj such that both di and dj belong to this cluster, the same cluster, and you take the dot product of that. And there are going to be, if this, the size of this cluster is C, then there are going to be C square such pairs. Okay? And you would basically do for I, for j, bi dot dj. Right? And then you play with this, in essence, what you will be showing is you can get the group average tightness measure, group average distance measure within the cluster as the square of the centroid. Again, because the distance is dot product distance, and so you can distribute it. Okay, so there are some advantages, it turns out, for the distance measure we are using, at least in computational sense. Okay. Now, the other thing that I mentioned earlier on is after you make the cluster, you presumably, I assume, you'll try some clusters in one of your projects. In the third part, many people try doing clustering and see if it improves search engine performance in terms of precision recall. The tricky question, of course, is if you make a cluster, you must give a description of the cluster that users can see, other than saying cluster 1, D1, D2, D9, D17. Cluster 2, D15, D95, D39. Nobody would understand what clusters those are. So we have to give some description, and this idea is actually a pretty nice idea, and there is a start of providing cluster summaries. As I said earlier, you consider picking the words from the cluster that are most representative of that cluster. And you can think of it in terms of TF-ICF value, where ICF is the intra-cluster inverse cluster frequency instead of inverse document frequency. So think of each cluster as a single document, you know, because bags can be combined. Each cluster is a single document, and then you consider the TF with respect to the cluster itself and ICF with respect to the other clusters. Okay, and that's not a bad idea as ideas go. So you can actually use that as the beginning of the description of what might be there in that cluster. Okay. And the other thing, of course, is if you're computing these, you better make sure that you are, you know, you optimize your computations for sparse vectors, because the whole thing is, you know, the documents are sparse vectors, okay, and you're computing distances multiple times across documents. Yes?
When we choose the words for the cluster description, do we choose mutually exclusive words for different clusters? And if we do, do we have any algorithms how to pick, like, to use this word for this cluster?
It's a good question. I actually don't offhand know the answer. I would think there are advantages for finding mutually exclusive, but I think doing ICF already almost gets you there to some extent. Okay, because if you only take frequency, then every cluster would be, the most important word in every cluster would be the, because every cluster has, you know, a whole bunch of the's, you know. But in this, ICF kills the right away, and it also could kill. I don't actually know the complete answer to your question, but you know, you could consider what could you do in terms of, first of all, would you want keywords to be mutually exclusive? That, you know, in a way, the clusters are mutually exclusive, the way we are computing, because they're disjoint. But meaning-wise, they might actually not be mutually exclusive. So the documents-wise, they are disjoint. But meaning-wise, they may not be disjoint. Because the documents, you know, basically you're thinking of documents as, you know, bags of words. And you could actually be, it may be reasonable to provide as the fourth keyword description of a particular cluster, the same word which happens to be the first keyword description of this cluster. And also, I think the commas matter. So if you say word 1, comma word 2, comma word 3, word 1 is the most important description of this cluster. Okay. I think it's a good question. There could be ways to improve, you know, to make them mutually exclusive. But I'm just giving you one idea as to what you can do. Okay. These we already talked about. You could use it, you know, all the various places you could use clustering in the text search. We talked about it the first class. Okay, this is, I just mentioned this, Steinbeck et al. Point out that they do some experiments and show that k-means seem to be doing fine. Okay, let me end with this slide for clustering, and then we'll sort of shift over to classification, which is just, which is also useful for text documents, and we actually mentioned this in the back of our head many times, you know, as in fact we said, retrieval itself can be thought of as classification. Okay, so we'll get there in a minute. But let's talk about some interesting points. One issue of clustering is distances are bad. You know, your clustering is just as good as your distances. Okay, and if you know what is the right distance measure, then you have already taken care of most of the important issues. After that, all you're doing is twiddling things such as, should I want, you know, chain-oriented clusters versus spherical clusters. Okay. Now, the problem is distance measures for, you know, for text documents, we know all the problems with distance measures. One issue, of course, is in the high dimensions, the distances between most vectors winds up being equal to zero. Right? Remember that during clustering, unlike during retrieval, where the only similarity you are computing is between a query and each document, in clustering you are computing more or less distance between each document and every other document, depending on your clustering algorithm. Okay? So the fact that the documents are high dimensional has both the problem that the distance computation is costlier, and also the problem that the distance computations are probably not going to be meaningful. Okay, and so this is what we talked about when we mentioned latent semantic indexing. So you can reduce the dimensionality of the data and then do clustering. Okay, so the same LSI that you did, you could use to reduce the dimensionality first and then do clustering. Okay, and as I mentioned in the beginning of the clustering topic, there were search engines which tried doing this. There are at least prototype search engines which tried doing this. The trickiest part, of course, is doing LSI fast enough. Fast in terms of the high, you know, the most important real estate, which is after the query and before the answer. Okay. The other thing, of course, is any better distance measure between documents will also lead to better cluster. Now, since most of us plan to do clustering, not most of us, I mean, one obvious reasonable place to do clustering would be only on the search results rather than on the entire corpus. So one idea could be to let the retrieval take place using a bogus distance measure such as vector similarity, because that's the best you can do with so many documents. But then having gotten 100 documents and you are clustering them, use more, a costlier but more sophisticated distance matrix. Okay, we mentioned, for example, that distance matrix between documents, distances between documents can be improved, for example. In one way of improving them is to do either shingle-based comparison of documents, okay, or phrase-based comparison of documents, both of which are different from just bag-based comparison. Okay, phrases essentially are a sequence of words appearing together. And if you do comparison, if you actually detect the phrases and consider that entire phrase as a word, and then use that as the basis for your vector similarity, your distance measure is likely to be better. Okay. Now clearly, it is better also for retrieval. If you could do this at the original retrieval, you would get better top 100 results. But if you couldn't do it because of cost consideration, you might be able to do it still after the top 100 results. Okay, and people have tried that. So doing phrase analysis, using phrase analysis based distance measures between documents. Now, again, this is not that any idea which works here could have also worked for the original retrieval. The only reason you don't use it for the entire retrieval might be because computation and feasibility. There's just too many documents over which you have to compute this measure there. Okay. Now, so sharing of phases, sharing of phrases, sharing of shingles, etc. And in fact, there was, one way of doing phrasal analysis is this idea called suffix tree analysis, which essentially tries to think of documents with the order between words taken into account and considering common suffixes between documents. Okay, I won't mention it, I won't go into the details, but you can look at, I think there's a paper. That paper is linked from the page, web page. Okay, this is phrase analysis using suffix trees. You know, and they have actually tried this for clustering of results. Okay. And then, you can also do distance measures on things other than content. Just that you'll get different kinds of clusters. And that could be the right clusters at some point of time. For example, in fact, one can argue that you can compute, one way you can compute communities on the web is to do link analysis and do clustering using link analysis. Okay, there are actually a whole variety of, so for example, if you are taking a fully graph theoretic view of clustering, so if you're thinking in terms of links, you're thinking in terms of graphs with vertices and edges. Okay, so you have, let's say there, and then, so that's a graph, bunch of vertices and bunch of edges. Now, if you're trying to find clusters on that, what would you do? The usual place you start with would be, the simplest idea would be to look for strongly connected or close to strongly connected components, and those would be clusters. Okay, so for example, this piece, if you look at this piece looks like a cluster, this piece looks like a cluster, that piece looks like a cluster. Okay, and that sort of an idea, if you do that in the context of links, if you're taking link information between pages into account, the best way to think of them is in terms of unweighted graphs. Okay, we are currently, what we've been doing is distance, weighted graphs, because you have distances between points. But if you think in terms of unweighted graphs, then the first ideas that you talk about are closely, densely connected components, searching for densely connected components and saying that's a cluster. Okay, and then if you didn't expect a cluster and you found a cluster there, then that must mean something. So you might wonder, what are these people having in common? And I may have mentioned this in the past, but there is some work, there's a paper that's linked from the readings called Trawling the Web for Communities. And there they actually found certain densely connected components and then found afterwards, what do they have in common? What exactly are they talking about? The way you go about, you're going walking on the street and you see like 15 people closely talking to each other. You go become the 16th person and try to see what's going on. What are they talking about? And so if there is like a community there, what's common between them? And they found all sorts of interesting communities which you wouldn't have thought existed, upfront. Okay, and then of course, next thing Department of Defense was interested because terrorists must be talking to each other and, we should trawl the web for terrorist links, etc. But, again, clustering with respect to, we looked at clustering with respect to content-based similarity measures, but you can also think of clustering with respect to this link-based measure. Okay, so that's the whole other direction there. Okay, I think I'll stop for that there. Do we have any questions on this? Yes.
When you can closely relate it to the shape of the clusters, right?
Distance is closely related to the shape of the cluster size.
If the clusters are not like a sphere, like a bar, so for what kind of distance we should choose? We should choose the closest between clusters.
I'm not sure I understand your question. So you.
I mean the distance between clusters may have some influence. May be related to the original shape of the cluster, but we don't know the shape of the cluster.
Yeah.
But how to choose the distance?
No, I mean, the whole thing is unsupervised, so obviously, I was thinking you may be asking something completely different, but the answer to this question, I don't know. Basically, if you know how clusters look like, so in fact, one of the interesting ideas is in a fully unsupervised world, you have no hope of doing anything. So for example, if your friend tells you that the clusters in this world tend to be elongated, right? What between single link, complete link, and centroidal distance measures, which would you pick? Single link. But that only made sense because your friend came and told you this. Okay. Now, this is basically why this idea of semi-supervised clustering, which is if you think of clustering completely as unsupervised, then you're hoping that your algorithm would tell you something about the real world. You know, sometimes it might tell, sometimes it might not, okay? But if you happen to know something about it, so one interesting area is if you know some partial knowledge about the domain, like for example, in your case, I mean, in fact, I had a slide which talked about the kinds of knowledge could be, I know how many clusters are there. That's very useful. K-means can use it, okay? I know representatives of each of the clusters. Very useful. K-means can use it. I know things which don't fall in the same cluster. This and this never fall in the same cluster. I don't know any other thing, but this and this are definitely very different. So instead of representative, I tell you, here are some which belong to this cluster. I mean, here are pairs which do not belong to the same cluster, for example. So I don't know which clusters they belong to, but they definitely don't belong to the same cluster. Okay, so these all act as constraints in basically on the k-means clustering, such that certain types of clusters are removed. And I haven't thought about the version you talked about, which is interesting enough too, I think, which is if somebody comes and tells you, look, all I know about the domain is that the clusters are of a particular shape. Okay, how do you use that information? Well, presumably, I think the best I can think of right now on my feet is you probably could use that in defining the inter-cluster distance. Okay, but in terms of, not in terms of defining it from scratch, but in terms of saying, of the three or four ideas we talked about, which would make most sense? If the clusters are spherical, centroidal distance would be enough. Okay, if the clusters are chain-shaped to begin with, then you have to go with, I mean, if you know that the real world has chain-shaped clusters, then you have to go with single link. Otherwise, you are likely to find centroidal, I mean, spherical cluster. K-means is sunk anyway. K-means, all clustering algorithms are making assumptions, right? And if their assumptions wind up, this is why I brought up the dendrogram thing, and you know, you all probably find it extremely funny to have evolution explained by a bunch of computer science geeks trying to do hierarchical agglomerative clustering on some gene data. Okay, but more or less that's what you're doing when you are clustering text results. Okay, the only thing, the way you'll figure out if your clustering is good or bad is if users are ever using your clusters or not. You know, if they're not, then they're giving you indirect feedback as to whether or not the clusters you're finding are useful, which at least is hopeful. But I'm worried about the evolutionary guys because there's no quick way of finding out, you know, whether we are right or wrong. And in fact, you know, I don't mean to belittle this field, but there is no other way. All they're trying to do is find out the big missing gaps in the evolutionary tree that leads to us. You know, like thousands of years sometimes, you know, thousands of, you know, generations are missing. And you need to fill that up. Okay?
There is another way.
What?
There
Bush, yeah. No. There is a much better way, which I wanted to show you, but you know, since you mentioned it, I'll show you. There is this. That's the way. That's basically, you can avoid the entire evolution thing. This is the cult of flying spaghetti monster who apparently made the world. And you should read this. It's pretty beautiful. So the spaghetti monster, and so they basically do all these great kinds of analysis and point out that the real reason there is global warming is because of the lack of pirates. Okay? So you notice, for example, you know, it's a clear-cut case, right? 1620, more pirates, smaller amount of temperature. By the time you come to 2000, very few pirates, apparently only 17. And then the temperature increased. And so there is obviously alternate explanations, and you should read this, you know, the FSM, the cult of FSM. And so this guy actually wrote, he made this up. At the time, Kansas Board of Education decided that equal time should be given to creation, intelligent design as well as evolutionary theory. And so this guy said, I completely agree with it, but I believe that there are more intelligent design theories than one that you're talking about. There's this other intelligent design theory called FSM, which is, you know, cult of flying spaghetti monster. And so what he was suggesting was that we should use one third of the time for flying spaghetti monster way of the world, one third for the intelligent design theory, and one third for time-tested hypothesis and hypothesis-proven evolutionary theory. That way everybody would be happy. So yeah, I completely agree, but that's a different story. No, but I do want to point out that much of the time, the right ways this would happen is even in the evolutionary genomics. In fact, there's a big center for evolutionary genomics in the AZ Biodesign Institute there. And there's a bunch of CS people. Are any of you guys working for Sudhir Kumar's lab? No, okay, so you can work for him, and you know, one of the interesting things is that obviously they don't just come up with this, you know, cluster and say, you know, write a Nature article. What normally happens is these clusters might suggest to them what sort of experiments they have to do, additional experiments they have to do. That's about the best you can do. Okay, but ultimately, you don't expect miracles. If you ever start taking the machine more seriously, I mean, the clustering more seriously than what you know about the domain, then you're in trouble. You know, you basically, you can't expect too many miracles. I mean, it has to improve. If you don't know anything about the domain and the clusters you get, the chance that those actually talk about anything relevant in the world is kind of hard, low. Okay. So, one other thing, since we just talked about that, let me see, should I start this today? Let me make this one other point, which is that the most important way you can change clustering is to change the distance measure. Okay, and one way you could do that, for example, is to say not all features, for example, even if you're going with any sort of Euclidean distance measures, it's not very clear which features are important, which are not important. Like I told you, I mean, I can give a nice Euclidean distance measure based on your hair length, which will give very nice clusters which may have nothing, no use for any specific application I might be looking for. Okay. One interesting issue is, are there ways of trying different nonlinear distance metrics between features? Okay, and one way of understanding that, there's this whole area called kernel-based clustering methods. Okay, kernel PCA, kernel k-means, everything. Okay, what you're doing there, one way, an intuitive way of looking at it, is that you are considering nonlinear distance measures between points and trying to see if any one of them might give you better clusters. Okay. Okay. So we will start talking about classification. Obviously, I'll only get to do one slide or two today, but we'll talk next time. So classification is also very central for text search engines. In some sense, you could say that to the extent information retrieval is about figuring out what is relevant, what is not relevant. If the user tells you, these are the things that are relevant, and these are the things that are not relevant, and they don't know exactly how to explain why they are relevant, why they are not relevant, you could learn from just the examples. So the difference between classification learning and clustering is, in clustering you are given a bunch of points, that's it. Okay? And you're trying to look for groupings of those points. And in classification, you're given a bunch of points, and you're also given labels on them. You're saying, these are red points, these are green points. Now the question is there a clean way, given a new point whose color you don't know, but it would be either red or green, is there a clean way of assigning it to the right class? Okay, now notice the following thing. Suppose you started with a bunch of points without knowing whether their colors at all, and you did clustering, and you found that there are two clusters. There is cluster 1 and cluster 2. And now suddenly you found that you missed a point earlier on, and there's this point sticking around there. Now you need to throw it into, rather than start clustering all over again, you want to throw it into one of the clusters. Then by that time it's classification learning, because you already have clusters. You have cluster 1, cluster 2, and you have a point, and you can decide which cluster should this point belong to. Okay? So when you come to classification learning, you already assume that clusters have been made by somebody. They know what the clusters are. They have given you samples from each of the clusters. And they told you this corresponds to this cluster, this corresponds to this cluster. So given a new point, you're trying to decide which cluster to throw it in. Okay? So learn to predict the class level of new unseen examples. Okay? And the difference between that and the clustering I just mentioned. There are many, many uses of it, of course. I didn't write this here, but the very first idea is retrieval itself. It can be thought of as classification, because the user shows you these are relevant, these are not relevant. So this is a relevant cluster, there's an irrelevant cluster, and I gave you samples from the relevant cluster, I gave you samples from the irrelevant cluster, and given a new document, I need to tell which cluster would it fall. Okay? Then, of course, other things like spam mail detection. Given an article from a random news group, trying to guess which news group does it belong to. Okay? And then, as I said, this should have been higher up. Is the article relevant to the user? And then also, more interestingly, one other idea is this page likely to lead me to pages relevant to my topic? Okay? Now, why would I ask such a question? Suppose I'm trying to generate a search engine which is only going to do bicycle-based information, all information about bicycles. Or a search engine whose only interest is all information about computer science papers. Okay? Now, as I said, one way of crawling for this search engine is to take Google's crawl and remove everything that's not computer science machine. But a more useful way, if you are starting yourself, is to crawl the part of the world which is likely to have computer science papers. Okay? The question then would be, given a page which has a bunch of links pointing away from it, should I follow those links or not? One idea would be to see, is this page a computer science page or not? If I'm doing computer science documents, right? Is this page a computer science page? If so, then it will probably lead to computer science papers. If not, it won't. So I have seen a bunch of computer science pages, and I have seen a bunch of other pages which are not computer science pages. So I do a classification which all it does is looking at the page tries to say, yes, it's computer science, or it's on topic, or no, it's off topic. And if it's on topic, then I follow the links from it. This is the idea of topic-specific crawling. Okay, so you are actually crawling only the relevant pages that are likely to be relevant to this topic. Okay, now any of these classifications, since you are starting from small samples, you could be wrong. But that's the whole point of classification. So what we will do, presumably, next class is to look at a couple of classification ideas that seem to work best in text search. Okay, I might show something about naive-based classification, because that actually works wonders in text document classification. But even if that's not there, the simplest idea would be relevance feedback idea that you had, that is already a classification method. So if the user said D1, D2, and D5 are relevant, and the others, you know, D7, D9, and D15 are not relevant, one idea would be to take the centroids of both these documents, document clusters, given a new document, compute its distance to each of these centroids, and say it belongs to the cluster whose centroid it's closest to. That's an idea. So that's one text classification idea that you already know. Okay, and we will look at a couple more, and also look at from the point of view of text classification, some things that make a lot more sense. Again, classification is a general idea, just as clustering is. We'll look at it from just our interest. Okay? Have a good spring break. What?
What happened? We were just discussing that this also featured in the AI.
Yeah. I mean, it's AI. That's true. So, yeah, that's true. It is. So, since you guys showed up before the last class, before the spring break, all of you will get 1 day extension on whatever is the next homework. Just write it on the homework. So instead of punishing the people who didn't show up, I will reward you guys. Okay? I'm in a good mood. Ask me whichever you want. Okay, whichever. Whatever is the next one, just write it on that, saying I have shown up. And then there will be a question as to what I said at the end of the class. So. Have a good break.